listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Catherine the Great. With Schitt's Creek, Catherine O'Hara gave us an hilarious aria of flamboyance and ennui, and an allegory for our altered lives. She talks to Karen Valby about her early friendship with Gilda Radner, flubbed auditions, and the curative power of gratitude. Photographs by Art Streiber, styled by Rebecca Ramsey. Opening photo, Sheer Optimism. O'Hara, shot by drones, made lemonade for the socially distant crew. Catherine O'Hara is too gracious, too self-effacing, in short, too Canadian, to brag about the effect she has on people. But you don't have to look far to find someone who's happy to do it for her. Martin Short, for instance, remembers being mid-conversation with Tom Ford and Angelica Houston at a small dinner party in Los Angeles a few years back when his friend Catherine came through the door. Angelica went completely still, he says. She said, oh my God, I've got to meet her, I've got to meet her. It was like Paul McCartney walking in 1965. O'Hara's devotees don't just admire the arc of her career. They dote over all the tiny comedic choices. A character's limp, say, or her drowsy scorn, or her melodramatic way of wilting to the floor, that have made the people the actor has played so specifically and generously alive. In Home Alone, her bright blue eyes flooded with horror on the plane just before she screamed one immortal word, Kevin! In Beetlejuice, she bellowed, Deo! And then led her dinner guest in a supernaturally possessed dance number. In Christopher Guest comedies, she was the bent light bulb you could never look away from. Has anyone ever played drunk better than O'Hara did in Waiting for Guffman's Chinese restaurant scene? Has anyone captured Hollywood egomaniacs in their full and obscene vulnerability more hilariously than she did in For Your Consideration, in which she played Marilyn Hack, an actor unhinged by her own Oscar buzz? I didn't get nominated, screams Marilyn, while taking her trash to the curb one tragic morning. 4 out of 5 of those girls are going to lose. Big time. Way worse than me. I didn't even get nominated. I'm not gonna lose. I'm not gonna lose. As for O'Hara's latest tour de force in the dearly departed Schitt's Creek, there is something uniquely triumphant about a breakout role, a love story, no less, for an actor who spent decades getting passed over for romantic leading roles, coming to a woman in her 60s. For 6 seasons, the comedy from the Pop Network was the little Canadian engine that could, finally hitting critical mass when it got picked up by Netflix in 2017. Schitt's Creek gave O'Hara the chance to show us every glittering thing she can do. Her character, Moira Rose, former soap star, goddess of panache and despair, ineffectual mother, and beloved matriarch of a wealthy family, reduced to nothing, is now a TV icon headed into history. Networks down the line have pigeonholed or diminished the idea of what an older female character can be, says Dan Levy, who created the show along with his father, Eugene. Dan plays O'Hara's son, Eugene, her husband. So to be able to be a part of this moment for Catherine O'Hara at this point in her life and show the world that there is nothing sexier, nothing more hysterical than a woman over 50, that was the joy. Because you're dealing with a caliber of actor who is so seasoned. and so willing to make choices that are outside people's comfort zones. I think that's what Moira rose as a result of, Catherine having the runway to go for it. One Tuesday in Los Angeles, the woman who inspires all this commotion swings open the glass doors of her home and steps out onto her cheetah-spotted doormat to greet me. O'Hara wears a simple white blouse and black cigarette AG jeans, her feet in children's pinstripe socks and black loafers. She apologizes for the rain. The threat of the coronavirus is in the news, but a month away from forcing us all apart. So in lieu of a handshake, she suggests a hug. Oh, simpler times. Right away, she starts preparing me for what she's sure will be a disappointing conversation. In person, I'm just neat, oh, awesome, oh, lovely, and then I'll go on forever telling long stories. I'm nowhere near as interesting as Moira. O'Hara, a nice Irish Catholic girl from Toronto, is more focused on celebrating life than on selling herself. Inside her house, red Christmas lights wrap around the balcony overlooking the pool. She never took them down because she figured they worked for Valentine's Day, too. And Chinese New Year lanterns sit in planters from a recent party. There are piles of green shamrock decorations on the kitchen counter, which O'Hara has pulled out of the garage in anticipation of St. Patrick's Day. The white stone kitchen island is covered with bouquets of pink hydrangeas and hyacinths, as well as an enormous vase of white roses from Pop TV in honor of her 66th birthday. A day, fans on Twitter loudly declared hashtag Catherine O'Hara Day. Schitt's Creek may have ended, but O'Hara's stock is at an all-time high, with industry trades placing her atop the hot list of actors in demand during pilot season. The actor shakes her head. "I don't know what's happening," she says. Suddenly, Hollywood is looking at her the way Angelica Houston does. She pours tea and arranges cookies on a plate. We sit in her large open kitchen in a nook by the windows. Jars of beautifully colored pencils rest on the table. She bought them in hopes of drawing again, though she hasn't yet. At first, answers to questions about her life end with her cheerfully muttering more self-deprecations, blah, 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 what am I even saying? Or feel free not to quote me and just write, "I think what she meant to say is." O'Hara only truly relaxes and gives herself over to memory and impersonation when talking about others. O'Hara's stories about growing up, the sixth of seven children in a family that loved to laugh, are told with immense love and care. Her eyes water briefly when talking about her parents, who died within 10 months of each other. "My father was a beautiful, shy man," she says. "He always said he would never meet anyone if it weren't for my mom, because she would talk to anybody. But if we ever got down, he'd say, 'Just say, I'm the greatest.'" She lowers her voice and pumps her fist like he told her to, laughing at the memory of her modest father, who worked a desk job for Canadian Pacific Railway, exhorting her to proclaim her worth. "My father told great jokes he brought home from the office, and my mother imitated everybody. I like to think I'm a combination." The trajectory of O'Hara's life changed forever when she was a teenager, and her older brother started bringing his girlfriend, Gilda Radner, to dinner with the family. "When Radner came over," says O'Hara, "my mom would definitely break out the good plates." Inspired by Radner's acceptance into the original Toronto cast of the musical Godspell, O'Hara auditioned as well. She got a call back, but not ultimately a place in the show. "That's okay, it's fine, still bitter," she jokes. O'Hara did, however, get to observe the cast members backstage. Eugene Levy, Victor Garber, Andrea Martin, and Martin Short among them, and it lit a fire of possibility. She recalls seeing Short in Godspell for the first time. I took the program home, and I remember kissing his picture because I thought he was so adorable, and dating Levy very briefly years later. I think we went out to breakfast once. I think we must have kissed, but nothing further, because he was a gentleman, and I'm a good Catholic girl. More than all that, she remembers Radner treating her like an adored younger sister. She had me sleep over one night, and then in the morning, we sat there at her little kitchen table with a pretty cloth, says O'Hara. We had tea and pumpernickel bread with cream cheese and cucumbers. You come from the suburbs. Something like that is so cool and chic and exotic. When O'Hara turned 17, Radner gifted her a book of 17 coupons, bearing promises like, I'll take you shopping, and I'll do your hair. Still, the actor is quick to disabuse me of the notion that she must have been special to have been loved so well by her friend. No, seriously, that wasn't about me, she says, shaking off the suggestion. Every one of my family will have the same kind of stories. She was like that with everyone. Before long, O'Hara followed Radner to Toronto's Second City Improv Troupe, serving initially as her friend's understudy. Gilda wore a lot of funny hats and glasses, so I did the same. She also watched Radner, who died in 1989, bring lovability to every role, no matter how absurd or deranged. This, of course, is precisely what O'Hara has been doing for years. Everyone has been in love with Catherine since she was 17, says Short. No one made me laugh like her on stage. And she always brought a humanity to her characters. They always had a bent reality, but they were never not kind. Toronto's Second City Troupe went on to do 6 seasons of the Canadian sketch comedy show SCTV. They've all stayed friends forever, and Martin Scorsese staged a reunion in 2018 to start shooting footage for an upcoming Netflix special. Lately, they've been gathering around O'Hara's Island, working on new material, and telling stories about beloved friends long gone, like Radner, John Candy, and Harold Ramis. Candy, who starred with O'Hara in Home Alone, died in 1994, on O'Hara's birthday, as it happens. Oh, it was terrible, she says. I got some mixed phone calls that day. Happy birthday, and oh my God, yeah, I'll always remember the day he died. A Canadian TV interviewer once asked Candy why his friend O'Hara didn't work more often. Did she even want to be a star? I don't think Catherine wants to play the wife, Candy said. He went on to describe how O'Hara turned down Beverly D'Angelo's role in the National Lampoon's Vacation movies because she didn't see the character. O'Hara left Canada for Hollywood in the late 1980s, not for her career, but for love. She had fallen for production designer Beau Welch on the set of Beetlejuice. The couple married and raised 2 sons, now in their 20s, who are employed as a set dresser and in set construction. Both sons worked on Schitt's Creek to give you a deeper sense of how dreamy the gig was for her. I know that doing SCTV really opened the doors, O'Hara says, of her first years in L.A. Chris Columbus and John Hughes didn't make me audition for the mom part in Home Alone. I met with them, and I guess I was close enough to the character somehow, or they just ignored what I was like in the meeting and hired me anyway. O'Hara remembers running into her co-star, Macaulay Culkin, a few years ago. I opened my arms and said, baby. Culkin called her mom and fell into them. O'Hara insists that early on, she routinely flubbed auditions. She describes meeting with a Canadian network head about a comedy show and the executive asking if she did any characters. I told him, oh yeah, lots. I do a woman who's lost all her teeth and she talks really funny, and another woman who's always mad at her husband, so she's got this kind of angry voice. She wraps her head with her knuckles. I described them, and bad descriptions, too. Warming to the theme of her own screw-ups, O'Hara says that she was desperate to play the Holly Hunter role in broadcast news, and that James L. Brooks called her after her first audition to tell her how amazing she was. After blowing the second audition, O'Hara wrote Brooks a letter. "I know how I blew it," she told him. "Please let me go again." So he called her in for a third audition, and then a fourth, with one of the stars, Albert Brooks, which seems to have been a disastrous chemical misfire. On the way out the door, O'Hara remembers James Brooks stopping her and asking, "What happened to you?" The third and final entry in O'Hara's Tales of Terror is the most adorable and possibly the most revealing. She auditioned to play the wife in a Robert De Niro movie. The casting people asked her to read a scene set in bed, so O'Hara slid down in the chair, trying to seem like she was lying down. She recreates it for me on her kitchen chair, her chin tucked unflatteringly into her chest, and her legs stretched out akimbo. Really attractive, right? Yes, it may have been a poor choice, but as Candy said, she didn't actually want to play the wife. We could have used a lot more of O'Hara over the years, but with Schitt's Creek, she gave us everything. The actor spent enough time at SCTV and in Christopher Guest improvised movies to make collaborating with Eugene and Dan Levy feel like a homecoming. She was so sure of the boundaries of what the character would and wouldn't do, says Dan Levy. O'Hara came up with Moira's vague European parlor accent, as well as her obsession with wigs. She also elevated the character's grande dame vocabulary into the stratosphere of absurdity with words like unicinuous. Unicinuous is fun, the actor says with a laugh. It means equally stupid, as in, a number of unicinuous ideas have been put forward today. Most of all, O'Hara insisted that Moira and her husband Johnny, played with such elegance by Eugene Levy, remain in love throughout the crisis that finds them owning, operating, and living in a shabby, forgotten motel in a town they once bought as a joke because of the name. Theirs is a deeply romantic story of a man thoroughly enchanted by his mercurial wife. Rewatching Schitt's Creek now, as many have been doing for comfort and escape, Moira suddenly seems like all of us, forced to live a terrifying new life that resembles nothing of our past one. Moira is unapologetic about hating every second of her new normal, even as she grows closer to her family and her better self. It's hard to conceive of any other actor managing to make Moira as dear as she is outrageous. When I ask O'Hara if she kept anything from Moira's closet, she disappears into her bedroom for a minute and returns with a divine pair of black lace-up Givenchy platform booties in one hand and an armful of luxury draped over her other arm. The Michael Kors sequin shift that Moira wore to her son's boyfriend's coming-out party in Season 5, a Celine tuxedo, and a McHugh Alexander McQueen coat. "And look at this dress," she says fondly, holding a slinky above the knee item out in front of her. "Apparently, I love Givenchy. It's really tight, but in a good way. How many older women get to wear short dresses or skirts? I did, as Moira." In the days leading up to our visit, O'Hara admits that she felt a little adrift. "At one point last week, I was feeling grouchy or something," she says, "a little disturbed. Every once in a while, it hits me." This is the time of year she'd be leaving for Toronto to start anew on Schitt's Creek, and now it's done. "I don't see trying to top this," says O'Hara. "How greedy can one person be? When I was growing up, my mom would say every day, 'Just be thankful for your health. Get up and be grateful that you're awake. You're here for another day.'" It's against O'Hara's practical nature to fantasize about goals, but she admires the hell out of Melissa McCarthy. She's so funny and fearless and such a great actor. and is riveted by Succession. The actors and the writing are all so good. Everyone's despicable, but you love them one moment, and the next, they're awful again. Her plan for now is to write for herself. She won an Emmy for writing for SCTV, and if she's going to work, she wants to feel devoted. "When I do take a job, I work really, really hard," she says. "I forget that I'm a wife, that I have a husband and kids. I'm completely there. I think talents are God-given, and it's your job to take care of them and share them with the right people," and she stops and gives herself a magnificent eye roll. Blah, blah, blah. Last year, O'Hara was nominated for her first lead actress in a comedy Emmy for Schitt's Creek, and it was the first time a stylist dressed her for a red carpet. She and Eugene Levy were determined not to let her slip into the sweaty desperation of her For Your Consideration character. O'Hara wrote an acceptance speech, just in case. She says when she's nervous, she can't be trusted to remember her own name, but lost. True to form, she's gracious about it. "The only thing I was bummed about was that I didn't get to do my bit, which I thought was funny. I swear it's not about not getting the award. It's, oh, I had such a good bit." Before we say goodbye, I beg her to share the bit with me. She looks horrified and waves her hands. "You can't share a bit," she says. "It's bad form, and it could still be usable, in case I get another chance." quiet on set. Over 5 days in March, the multimillion-dollar machinery of television production ground to a halt. Showrunners, crew members, and executives recount the week that everything changed and try to imagine the road back by Joy Press. Additional reporting by Anthony Bresnikan and Joanna Robinson. Opening photos, The Before Times, the Law and Order Special Victims Unit set during the 18th season. And Clocked Out, the Law and Order SVU squad room set under wraps. By March 6th, Rikers had started to feel dangerous. Law and Order Special Victims Unit is filmed on a soundstage at Chelsea Piers in Manhattan. There are sets for the courthouse, the interrogation rooms, the district attorney's office. But what troubled showrunner Warren Light that Friday was the replica of a Rikers prison cell. It's a windowless, uncomfortable room, and it doubles as a holding area for the many background actors who populate NBC's crime drama. If we're doing a courtroom scene, says Light, we might have 100 extras in there. The large cinderblock hallway outside the cell seemed problematic as well, because it also functions as the show's catering area. Everybody eats the meals together, so they're on the line, one person after another, taking the big spoon and dolloping stuff onto their plate, says Light. And also, you're passing equipment back and forth, props back and forth, costumes back and forth, makeup. We were all obsessively washing hands, but I walked by Rikers and I thought, this is scary. At the time, there were only 44 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the state of New York. The city's hospitals were not yet besieged, the morgues not yet overflowing, the air not yet pierced by near-constant sirens. But Light had read enough to know that the pandemic was galloping toward them. On Monday, March 9th, he proposed what had previously been unthinkable, shutting down production. Later, he would learn that showrunners from other studios had gotten a similar reaction initially. That first day, he says, I was met with derision. Television shoots operate with tight safety restrictions. Even if you're a writer who's sitting in a chair behind the camera, you will get sent home by the safety guy if you have open-toed shoes, says Light. But the invisible nature of the virus made it difficult for executives in Los Angeles, as well as people in virtually every other walk of life, to wrap their heads around the threat. Light explained that most of his crew rode the subway to work. This is an outbreak waiting to happen, he said. One beloved SVU crew member, costumer Josh Walwork, went home early that Monday, not feeling well. He later died from COVID-19. The week of March 9th upended the television industry, just as it upended everything else. Over the course of 5 days, the intricate multimillion-dollar machinery ground to an unprecedented, groaning halt. At the start of that week, many had been oblivious to the danger. On the Monday, Vanity Fair asked the showrunner of a popular prestige drama whether the outbreak would interfere with his show's upcoming shoot. The showrunner seemed befuddled by the question. He'd been so busy that COVID-19 had barely impinged on his consciousness. Others flinched at suspending production, which would cost millions and inflict unemployment upon crew members and actors. As Americans of every kind began contemplating the ever-increasing prospect of contagion and a quarantine with no clear end, the television industry scrambled to figure out how it could keep turning out entertainment for a world voracious for distraction. There was no roadmap for how to proceed. And what executive wanted to be the first to make such a drastic move? So production chugged on. Series and pilots continued to shoot around the country. As late as Thursday, March 5th, the day after Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency in California, HBO held a lavish Hollywood premiere for the third season of Westworld, where attendees gamely fist-bumped instead of hugging. "Look, it's not real till it's real," says veteran film and TV producer Christine Vachon, who was filming Halston, Ryan Murphy's forthcoming Netflix series starring Ewan McGregor, when COVID-19 came to town. "So you have hand sanitizer around, and you wrap your craft service snacks in plastic and all of those things. It was the feeling of, okay, we can still shoot the show. Nobody's telling us we can't, so we'll do everything to make people as safe as possible." The industry had dealt with forces beyond its control before, of course. Julie Plec, mastermind of the CW series The Vampire Diaries and Legacies, and co-writer of the forthcoming Netflix political drama The Girls on the Bus, says she initially assumed that working around COVID-19 would be like making contingency plans for snowstorms. "That's happened to us several times over the last decade, where you were looking at the weather, trying to decide if the snow is going to hit and when it's going to start," she says. "The anxiety level of the crew can get to a point where, even if it hasn't snowed yet, we send them home because it's not worth the risk." In Chicago, showrunner Noah Hawley was deep into the fourth season of FX's Fargo with Chris Rock. Hawley had arrived on set on March 9th to direct an episode, only to discover that a crew member of the upcoming Fox show Next had tested positive. Some members of that crew had since joined Fargo. "We sent everybody home who had worked on that show first thing," says Hawley. "And then there was the scramble for information. Who was it? Were other people feeling sick?" After talking to executives, he gathered the team to tell them what he knew. "Everyone was really unsettled by the news," Hawley says. "We had a prop master whose girlfriend had worked on that other show, and we ended up sending him home just to be safe. But it did raise a lot of questions that were hard to answer, like, what's the level of exposure at which the risk is deemed too great?" Gloria Calderon-Kellett had begun doing risk analysis for her Pop TV series One Day at a Time, even before March 9th. One of the show's stars, Rita Moreno, is 88 years old, and in late February, as they prepared for the season premiere, Calderon-Kellett began to worry that the actor would be in peril if she traveled to New York for a talk show. "I went to her dressing room, and I said, 'Hey, listen, I know these are huge opportunities for the show, but don't be a hero.'" One Day at a Time began limiting the number of people allowed on set. On March 3rd and March 10th, they filmed without the usual live studio audience, a disquieting experience for an ensemble unaccustomed to real-time feedback. "Is this funny?" star Justina Machado asked the few crew members present, to which the crew yelled back, "Yes, you're hilarious. We'll try to laugh louder." Intensifying matters, broadcast networks were in the middle of pilot season, producing the first episodes of potential new shows. On Wednesday, March 11th, the day the White House announced it would bar travelers from most European countries, CBS's creative chief David Nevins showed up for a live taping of Be Positive from sitcom King Chuck Lorre and his mom collaborator Marco Pinette. The show revolves around an odd couple premise in which a man in need of a kidney, Silicon Valley's Thomas Middleditch, forges a bond with a potential donor, Annalee Ashford, from Masters of Sex. Nevins was elated to be working with Lorre, but a stark thought occurred to him. This may be the last audience show anywhere in America, and maybe the world, for a really long time. Out of 56 broadcast pilots, Be Positive would be the only one to complete production before the shutdown. "It was a magical night," says Nevins. "It had the feeling of end of days. You know, that night when the ship is going down and the band is playing one last time." In early March, of course, the U.S. economy was undergoing a kind of slow-motion car crash, and there was a chasm between the COVID-19 believers and non-believers. President Trump, for instance, was still insisting, just stay calm, it will go away. In the TV industry, the divide may have been compounded by a kind of macho, tough-it-out attitude among crews. Everybody prides themselves on being a workhorse, says Light. It's pouring rain, and it's ice cold. And you sit outside for 12 hours, and if you can't do it, you don't belong with us. In TV, as in all walks of life, it became difficult to tell what was real and what had been exaggerated. You'd hear that somebody was coughing on set, and others would say they didn't feel comfortable, says Jeremy Gold, the co-president of Blumhouse Television, which at the time had series in production for places like Showtime, Amazon, Hulu, and CNN. Is that a real thing? How serious do you take that? We were in constant huddles, and with each new piece of information came another decision about how to act. Gold says the famous line from Jaws, "We're going to need a bigger boat," began looping through his head. At every turn, this kept getting more dire and more serious. Bruce Miller, showrunner for The Handmaid's Tale, was shooting season 4 in Toronto with Elizabeth Moss making her debut as a director when he discovered that someone in the production might have been exposed to COVID-19 on another set. Then, locations where the show had planned to shoot began to shut their doors. Filming became impractical pretty quickly, says Miller, and we knew there would be a straw that broke the camel's back. An actor doesn't show up or can't get into the country. As international borders started closing, Miller also worried his actors might have trouble getting back home. Around the country, producers and executives conferred with one another about the escalating crisis. Inevitably, we are consulting with each other because we have co-productions, says Nevins from CBS. At first, he had hoped to make decisions on a case-by-case basis. For instance, postponing a production of The Talented Mr. Ripley with Fleabag's Andrew Scott, which was preparing to film in Italy this summer. Now something became abundantly obvious. There were going to be no clean places anywhere. Still, surprisingly little action was taken. By March 10th, as the number of known infections in the U.S. passed 1,000, only CBS's reality show, The Amazing Race, had publicly announced that it was halting production. Maybe the other networks and streamers thought that the show was an outlier, that its globe-hopping conceit made continuing logistically impossible. And, to be fair, it's not as if the executives over at the movie studios had figured out the way forward either. On March 10th, Disney went ahead with a red carpet premiere for Mulan, gathering 3,400 people inside the Dolby Theater in L.A. Wednesday, March 11th, was a turning point, however, not just for the television industry, but for America at large. The NBA's decision to suspend its season indefinitely, followed only minutes later by the announcement from Tom Hanks that he and his wife, Rita Wilson, were sick, came as a blaring wake-up call. In short order, the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus a pandemic, and the stock market fell precipitously. Finally, that same day, the CW teen drama Riverdale suspended production in Vancouver after discovering that someone on the show had been in contact with a coronavirus-positive person. As soon as that happened, everybody else felt safe to do it, says one producer, but you needed a first group to be the ones to step out. On Thursday, March 12th, as executives spent hours in meetings gaming out battle plans, the number of confirmed U.S. cases topped 1,300. Across the country, crews began rushing to complete the episodes they were working on. It's especially difficult to shut down that close to the finish line because you work yourself up into this kind of fever pitch at the end where you're trying to get everything, says Hawley, the Fargo showrunner. Not finishing likely meant that Fargo would not be able to air in time to be eligible for the Emmys. Hawley nevertheless called his executives at FX and MGM to tell them they needed to pull the plug, and between lunchtime and late Thursday afternoon, the mood had shifted to the point where no one argued. Everyone understood it just wasn't going to happen. We had to shut down. The next day, Holly learned that someone on their Los Angeles post-production team was symptomatic, so those staffers were sent home to self-quarantine. "Suddenly, I couldn't even edit the show," he recalls. "It is amazing how quickly we became paralyzed by events." A cascade of shutdowns followed. By Friday, March 13th, the day the U.S. declared a national emergency and Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti announced the city schools would be closing, American television had effectively come to a dead halt, hurling hundreds of thousands of people out of work. "It all ramped up so fast," says Rachel Schuchert, a writer on the Netflix series Glow. "The week began with people avoiding hugging or touching each other. By Friday, we were told we're shutting down." Not everything went into hibernation. A few series, like The Crown, rushed to finish episodes in progress. Late Night host quickly returned to the air, finding entertaining ways to shoot from home. And many writing staffs for scripted series transformed themselves into virtual writers' rooms on Zoom. The writers of Netflix's animated series, Big Mouth, began congregating virtually that Friday. Co-creator Nick Kroll also recorded cast members' voices from their homes. Maya Rudolph is recording in her living room, and so her kids are popping in and out of frame, which is so fun and sweet, says Kroll. But once the show about the miseries of puberty occasionally gets graphic, he found himself having to warn his star, "We're about to do a scene you may not want to have your children in the room for." The writers of The Walking Dead also quickly converted to working online. "It's kind of ironic to be writing about the apocalypse in the middle of the apocalypse," says writer Latoya Morgan. The team had spent an inordinate amount of time discussing survival tips without knowing one salient fact, that we actually could potentially need them in our real lives. Meanwhile, companies struggled to figure out how to safely complete post-production on shows that were nearly ready. Equipment for editing and sound mixing were delivered to some staffers' homes before offices closed down and Los Angeles's shelter-in-place order was issued. "We're going to see how inventive everyone can be," says Blumhouse co-president Marcy Wiseman. "Most people want to be inventive because they want to work." Hollywood executives had been anxiously anticipating a very different kind of apocalypse. The threat of a writer's strike in May when an agreement between the studios and the Writers Guild expired. That's one reason the new short-form streaming service, Kibi, had already squirreled away enough scripted content to last until Thanksgiving. But the production shutdown still disrupted its unscripted Daily Essentials series, which meant shifting the set for the music show Pop 5 into host Tim Cash's garage and the gaming show Speedrun into host Jimmy Mundell's living room. Friday the 13th was the day in which it was okay, this is no longer going to be business as usual, and if we don't instantly pivot, we're not going to make it to the finish line, says Jeffrey Katzenberg, founder of Kibi, as well as a former studio chief at Disney and DreamWorks. On a personal level, that instant pivot proved far easier for those in the industry's upper echelons. While executives, writers, and other employees who work in offices quickly transitioned to working at home, TV crew members exist in a gig economy. Most can't do their job virtually, and few were paid for more than a few weeks after productions shut down, if at all. "I'm really nervous that this could destroy me financially," says one showrunner's assistant. "When people think of Hollywood, they think of stars. But for behind-the-scenes people, it's a blue-collar job and everybody's scared." Although assistants have been checking in and making care packages for each other, she says, "I don't see higher-ups checking in with people on my level. It's almost like a caste system where the higher-ups communicate with each other and don't feel the need to reach out to the people that help make their lives easier. Someone who has a $10 million overall deal with Netflix, they're going to be okay. The below-the-line people are just totally screwed. The Relief Fund for Hollywood Support Staff, created by the group hashtag PayUpHollywood, quickly raised upwards of $500,000, buoyed by contributions from top-tier showrunners like Shonda Rhimes and Greg Berlanti, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, many of whose 150,000 union members have lost jobs in the shutdown, committed $2.5 million in donations to three entertainment charities. Netflix, too, pledged $100 million for those on their own halted productions, as well as nonprofits providing emergency relief to the industry. But with so many television workers staring into the void of long-term unemployment, the division between haves and have-nots continues to rankle. TV executives can't predict the future any better than anyone else, but this dramatic pause will almost certainly transform the way television is made. Which improvised and ad hoc solutions will end up becoming the new normal? Only time will tell what's an innovation that is better, cheaper, faster, helps the comedy, helps the storytelling, helps the intimacy, and what is just a temporary adaptation out of necessity, says Nevins of CBS. Calderon Kellett of One Day at a Time has been talking to other showrunners on social media, trying to imagine what a return to normalcy might look like. What would need to be in place for you to feel like your crew is safe to return to work, she asked, adding that she can't imagine moving forward without the ability to test for the virus daily. You think Rita Moreno is going to step on the set if she doesn't have 100% assurance? It's not worth her life. Nothing is. Miller, from The Handmaid's Tale, says he's been pondering ways to make a television show or a movie with only 10 people working together at a time. It's a very interesting challenge. Even for those working from the safety of home, it's a strange exercise to try to imagine the post-quarantine future. I was doing a rewrite yesterday, says Julie Pleck, and I thought, oh my God, the world is going to change completely as a result of this experience. You can't write a movie set in 1946 without acknowledging that World War II happened back then. What stories are we going to tell now? And how are we going to acknowledge what we've all just been through? You're writing present day without really knowing what the present day is going to look like. Thank you. Now on to books. Jam Session, a new cookbook from Squirrel, the cult favorite Los Angeles cafe, revisits its origin story at a moment when the pantry is a pleasure center, by Laura Regensdorf. In the photos, a raspberry rhubarb blend, a look inside the Squirrel Jam book, California peaches, preserves on ricotta toast. When I say picky, I did not eat fruit, Jessica Coslow says of her childhood palate, the sole exception being raspberries. In a twist, the chef grew up to be a produce whisperer, creating a line of jams in 2011 called Squirrel. When her cafe opened a year later, ricotta toast slicked with preserves drew devotees. Now, amid a bread-making boom, the Squirrel Jam Book proposes an apt hobby. Photographed by creative director Scott Barry, the book is full of unexpected whimsy, from impromptu sculptures to recipes that bubble like the La Brea tar pits. Seek out local fruit, or order a jar of Coslow's Persian mulberry. Jam sales have helped keep Squirrel aloft in this challenging time. Preserves, indeed. It's the heart and soul of everything that we do, she says. The Politics of Politesse, by Keziah Weir. There are two overarching goals of diplomatic protocol, to bridge and to persuade. Capricia Pinevich Marshall writes in Protocol, The Power of Diplomacy and How to Make It Work for You. The new book, from the former chief of protocol to President Obama and social secretary to the Clintons, serves as a how-to guide on ironclad etiquette. Marshall once had a table of high-powered dinner partiers making okay signs to learn that B for bread is on the left, D for drink is on the right. It's also a memoir of the perks and perils of the job, respectively watching Britain's David Cameron and Obama bond over basketball, accidentally adopting the accent of Her Majesty, the Queen. Admiration Society. Authors of Vanity Fair beloved novels out this summer share their own must-reads, old and new. David Mitchell, author of the frolicsome psychedelic rock drama Utopia Avenue, recommends Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, a jaw-droppingly accomplished novel about Shakespeare's family and ethos, the intertwining of art and life, and the dusk between life and death. Heartbreaking, and yet heart-mending, too. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Colexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.